Media app.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is...
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Linda Kenyon. A scuffle at the Western Wall after Hamas militants launched thousands of rockets into southern Israel. CBS's MTS Taieb says the militants also infiltrated Israeli communities.
Heavily armed Hamas fighters breached the Gaza barrier wall with southern Israel and stormed the streets of nearby border towns, setting Israeli tanks on fire in an assault Hamas are calling Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Hamas posted footage online of what it said was bodies of Israeli soldiers brought into Gaza by its fighters. CBS News has not been able to verify the footage, but Israel's military have confirmed that heavily armed gunmen had crossed the Gaza border fence in several locations.
At least 40 Israelis have been killed. Hundreds more are wounded. The president of the UAW will take part in rallies this weekend in the strike against the big three automakers, CBS's Jennifer Kuiper reports.
3 weeks after United Auto Workers members started striking, union president Sean Fain says progress is being made on their demands, including GM agreeing to put EV battery plant workers under the union's master agreement. So no additional walkouts this go-around, but Fain stressing the union will continue to flex its power.
We've shown the big three that we're not afraid to use it, and we have shown the big three that we are ready for a record contract when they are.
Fain will join Mayor Brandon Johnson and top leaders in Chicago for a rally with UAW members and head to another one in Detroit later this weekend. Jennifer Kuiper, CBS News, Chicago.
Some rather unpleasant weather stretching across the Northeast this weekend. Reynolds Wolf is at the Weather Channel.
The stormy situation where millions of people across the Northeast are going to be stuck in, I guess you could say, kind of an aquatic vice, so to speak, because you've got moisture coming from a variety of directions, and this is what could play out. The risk of flash flooding that runs through today through tomorrow morning.
The House Speaker job remains vacant after hardline Republicans and Democrats forced Kevin McCarthy out this week. CBS's Willie James Inman says Republicans Jim Jordan and House Majority Leader Steve Scalise are running.
Jordan is the founder of the Conservative Freedom Caucus and a leader of the Biden impeachment inquiry. Scalise is currently fighting blood cancer, but cleared to run by his doctors. McCarthy, meanwhile, said he plans to finish his House term, denying media reports to the contrary.
I'm still here finishing my job, all right?
You thinking about running for re-election?
Yes.
Simone Biles has become the most decorated gymnast in history.
I know my parents had a heart attack.
Biles won the individual all-around title at the World Championships in Antwerp, Belgium. This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed, because Indeed's all-in-one hiring solution helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
The lights are on.
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A new poll suggests most Americans are getting more comfortable with wind turbines, but as Mike Moan reports, local opposition is still a factor when new wind farms are proposed and developed.
The Washington Post University of Maryland poll finds 75% of Americans wouldn't take issue with a solar farm being built in their community. There's a similar result for wind farms. Josh Hone, who does consulting work for these projects with the firm Stantec, says it indicates a growing acceptance of what needs to be done to respond to climate change. But he says at the local level, these are land use decisions that can get the attention of the community.
Certainly there's an opportunity, there's a financial incentive to have them, but every project has a trade-off, especially in terms of aesthetics and the idea of community character, which I think is at the heart of a lot of opposition, or at least in terms of the rhetoric.
Hone says local leaders and developers need to be transparent right away about the scope of a project. He suggests this can help overcome backlash that sometimes can be clouded by misinformation. A study this year from Columbia Law School found at least 228 local restrictions across 35 states designed to limit such development. Hone also says stakeholders can do a good job in selling these projects by appealing to landowners.
There are many communities and many deals being made across the country that are really benefiting individual property owners, farms, to stay in the hands of the families who have had them for generations. And so there's a legacy to that.
He adds a careful approach is especially important right now as more federal support comes on board, potentially spurring development at a quicker pace. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Haller House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Haller House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, October 7th, 2023, and this is our second hour on this great morning here in Wisconsin. Here in the United States of America, we are talking about all things related to government, law, and the aspiration for justice in America. This, our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion of those most important stories in those areas important to our lives and our livelihoods in our state and in our nation. This hour, a part of our syllabus, we're going to talk more about fake electors. What is the status of those defendants who have been charged? Defendants who might be charged here in the state of Wisconsin. We're going to chat a little bit more about the basis for doing that and what that means in connection with the other cases pending in the jurisdiction in Georgia and also in the federal district court in Washington, D.C. Second, as a major portion of our presentation, our discussion this morning in the area of rule of law, we're going to spend some time talking about what happened at the United States Supreme Court just this past week. First Monday in October, just this past Monday, what did the Supreme Court take a look at? One of those three cases, the oral arguments before the Supreme Court just this past week. And then we're going to look forward to the next week. We've got three more cases also on the docket of the Supreme Court coming up for oral argument on the 10th and the 11th next week. I'm going to talk about those cases, the meaning of those cases as well. Stay with us for that discussion as well right here on Morning Cannolis. Before we get to all of that important discussion having to do with the United States Supreme Court, let us stay right here in the state of Wisconsin and talk about our fake electors and some of the things that have been said politically about what happened here. The 10 Wisconsinites who participated in what's been called the scheme to claim the state's 10 electoral votes for former President Donald Trump in 2020 should be charged and be held accountable. That's not me talking. That's the governor of the state of Wisconsin. He said that way back in early August when asked by a local reporter about whether he would feel confident in the state's elections going forward if the 10 fraudulent electors don't ultimately face charges. Our governor has gone on record saying that those fake electors should be charged. There has to be accountability, is what Tony Evers said. And they went on to say what they did was wrong. And so I'm hoping somebody will pick up the banner here because that has to happen. And beyond that, of course, our attorney general, his name is Josh Call, told reporters that he can neither confirm nor deny the existence of any investigation related to those fake electors here in the state of Wisconsin. But he did go on to say this. He said, it's critical that people who committed crimes with the intent of overturning the result of an election are held accountable. That, again, by our attorney general, seemingly in concert with what our governor has also said. So appropriate in the wake of those statements of this past August, and some of that repeated even more recently, to talk about where fee collectors stand. We know already that Fannie Willis, the attorney general there in Fulton County in Georgia, as a part of her omnibus, her sweeping indictment against 19 individuals, has charged some of the fake electors in that state. They're people who came forward, very much like the fake electors here in Wisconsin, who purported to be electors from the state of Georgia on behalf of the former president, Donald Trump. Their representation's false. Their engagement in that conduct in violation of the state law there in Georgia, according once again to the indictment returned by the indicting grand jury under the auspices of Fannie Willis. Again, we are always quick to add, they have not been found guilty. They are still presumed innocent, but strong indications that those individuals will in fact face justice and should in fact in the end be found guilty of doing just that. We know that one of the defendants, one of the bail bondsmen, as we said last week, already pleading guilty to things that he knows about in connection with that conduct, that omnibus RICO count there in Georgia, presumably also now assisting Fannie Willis in assembling her case going ahead against others indicted in that matter, presumably also the fake electors there. We know as well that the Michigan Attorney General across Lake Michigan in our sister state has also brought charges, felony charges, against 16 individuals for falsely portraying themselves as electors in that state. Again, in the 2020 election, the defeat of Donald Trump, each of those defendants in Michigan, much like the charges in Georgia, facing felony counts, including forgery, conspiracy to commit forgery, accusations that they signed documents attesting falsely that they were Michigan's duly elected and qualified electors for president and vice president. And again, the attorney general there, her name is Dana Nessel, she announced those charges and said they carried out these actions here in the state of Michigan with the hope and belief that the electoral votes of Michigan's 2020 election would be awarded to the candidate of their choosing instead of the candidate that Michigan voters actually chose. That case now proceeding to trial in the state of Michigan. So what about Wisconsin? What about Wisconsin and what is happening here? Well, once again, the attorney general has said that he neither confirms nor denies the existence of an investigation. We'll talk more about that in just a moment or so, but we know some things. We know some things about what did indeed happen here in the state of Wisconsin. 10 people gathered in the Wisconsin state capitol on December 14th of 2020. That's the date, of course, federally mandated for the meeting of the Electoral College, that happening in Georgia, in Michigan, in all other states throughout the country. By that point, by that time, the Trump team, if you will, the litigation team, had basically exhausted all of its available legal mechanisms for challenging the outcome in the state judicial system. And in fact, earlier that same day, that's December 14th, the Wisconsin Supreme Court had also issued a detailed written opinion on that day, confirming the results of the recount and establishing that Joe Biden had indeed been victorious in this state. What did that do? That foreclosed the possibility the litigation might change the results of some further challenges in that presidential election. And of key importance, really important in understanding what happened at that time, that ruling by the Supreme Court also conclusively resolved any questions under state law about the identity of Wisconsin's presidential electors. Wisconsin voters at that time and courts alike had definitively spoken in favor of the Biden electors at that time. We know that now. We knew that then. And several Trump administration officials even said in testimony before the January 6th committee, we've talked a lot about that on this broadcast, that by that date, by December 14th, they considered the election decisively over. It was done by December 14th. Yet 10 individuals, like these other fake electors in other states, principally the other so-called swing or challenge states around the nation, 9 of whom were nominated by the Republican Party to serve as presidential electors in the event of a Trump victory, went ahead as if they were the legitimate presidential electors. At noon, at the Capitol building, they generated and they signed documents, much like the allegations in Michigan and also the allegations in Georgia, mirroring and trying to mimic, if you will, genuine presidential elector certificates. And you can see those, you can look at those online, they're out there in the media.
And the group then effectively transmitted those documents to the U.S. archivist and other official recipients. And we've talked a lot about the reporting on the ways in which attempts were made to get those fake electoral documents to the well of the Congress on January 6th. Crucial for any future criminal prosecutions, near contemporaneous public statements suggest that that group was also very much aware. They knew well the Supreme Court had ruled about this matter hours before. And while they may have thought that they might eventually be declared Wisconsin's rightful presidential electors, which they never were, they knew that as of noon on December 14th, no official proceeding had endorsed, had embraced that notion, and in fact given any legitimacy to the notion that they were indeed legitimate electors. We know that the actual electors down the hall, also in the Capitol, were doing their properly designated, their properly authorized, pursuing their oaths as electors and returning the actual Electoral College indicators and the documents at that time. So we know in fact what happened on that day. So the question is, what about the Wisconsin electors? What should happen? Well, beyond the things that I reported on just a few moments ago, let's talk about some of the specific statutes in the state of Wisconsin, much like those in Michigan and in Georgia and other places around the country, that our Attorney General, the Office of the Attorney General, the Chief Law Enforcement Office in the state of Wisconsin, could in fact pursue under the Wisconsin Criminal Code as established today. We know that maybe most relevant, there's a Wisconsin statute called Section 946.69. It makes falsely assuming to act as a public officer a Class 1 felony. A Class 1 felony. It goes on to say, by exercising powers as if legally constituted as public officers, the fake electors might run afoul of that statute. They might also be guilty of misconduct in public office, that prohibited by another statute, Section 946.18. Both of those statutes might provide a basis for prosecution of those individuals right here in the state of Wisconsin. In addition, charges for a simulating legal process, that also in violation of Wisconsin law, that under Wisconsin Section 946.68 might be viable as well. Fake electors and those who assisted them might also be charged for conspiracy to commit those acts under Section 939.31, or as parties to a crime, often used by prosecutors to identify people who assist and support others in their criminal conduct. That's Section 939.31. What's more, even if a court finds that some of the actions of the false electors ultimately fell short of their real intended and presumably criminal conduct, the very attempt to commit this, any one of these acts, could be prosecuted likewise under Wisconsin statutes. Section 939.32 makes the attempt also a violation of the state law. All of those kinds of things, a basis for looking at and finding a predicate to charge them under Wisconsin criminal law. When we come back, we'll talk about a couple of other things related to the possibility of charging those fake electors in the state of Wisconsin, some of the strategic implications, and the implications for other cases, including that federal case right now pending in the United States District Court, and future prosecutions that might happen there as well. Stay with us for that discussion. Jim Santel.
The most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. cents. The pin still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pin still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network. Red Delicious, Honey Crisp, Granny Smith. If you have a favorite apple, now is the time to pick it straight from the source. Did you know Wisconsin has more than 300 apple orchards? Travel Wisconsin recently naming its favorites, including the Oneida National Apple Orchard outside Green Bay, Ferguson's Orchards in Eau Claire, and Apple Holler south of Racine. Many provide tons of family fun in the fall, too. Tire swings, lawn bowling, hay rides, and more. Apple experts suggest if you want to pick yours fresh, do it before the end of October. For Civic Media, I'm Terry.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, a few sprinkles, otherwise mostly cloudy and 52. 42 the low tonight and 55 the high for your Sunday. Frost Sunday night as we drop into the mid to low 30s. Mostly clear skies overnight for Monday sunshine and a high near 51.
Currently 46 degrees.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back. We are talking in this second segment of our second hour here in Morning Cannolis about the Wisconsin electors. Again, obviously in connection with other prosecutions going forward in Georgia and in Michigan, and presumably at some point as well in the United States District Court in the District of Columbia. We know that Jack Smith has already brought this singular defendant case against Donald Trump. There are plainly other things that he is also going to do. He has identified in that indictment out there in Washington, D.C., a number, specifically six unindicted co-conspirators. We know who those are. And we also know from previous statements by the Deputy Attorney General, her name is Lisa Monaco. Department of Justice is also looking at this fake electors issue, not just in the state of Wisconsin, but presumably in all the other states. So it raises the question, well, gee, if we go ahead and prosecute in the state system here, just as the Michigan Attorney General is doing, just as the state district attorney there in Georgia is doing, what about the connection to the federal prosecution? Does that in any way implicate or affect or in any way destroy or undermine that prosecution out there if it happens, and it probably will, in the federal court in Washington, D.C.? And the short answer is no. It happens all the time. All the time there are parallel, similar federal and state prosecutions. Right now, the very fact that there is a state prosecution both in Michigan and in Georgia, could be other prosecutions in some of those other states that do not in any way right now affect the federal prosecution. Again, that case involving just Donald Trump, but also not prevent the federal government at some point down the road from prosecuting under federal law the state electors charge under state law. In other words, even if there are signs that the U.S. Department of Justice is investigating the fake electors scheme, there is nothing about that situation that precludes the possibility of parallel proceedings here in Wisconsin and the state courts in other states around the nation. The potential state law violations that described in the previous segment also would give the state courts jurisdiction here and provide us an important role to play in addressing the crimes committed here in the state of Wisconsin under these circumstances, particularly when the investigations might prioritize here in the state of Wisconsin different actors. Could be different from those that Jack Smith and others may prosecute down the road in the federal system. Both levels of prosecution, again, can go ahead. They can go ahead in parallel tracks, and both may prevent some perpetrators in the future in different ways from doing this in the future. We've talked a lot about that particular aspect.
It sends the message that under state law and potentially under federal law as well, this kind of conduct is prohibited. Sends the message to future false or fake electors that this conduct cannot be tolerated. It will be the subject of prosecution, could be both in state and federal venues. That's an important thing to accomplish. State prosecutors are also more inclined, if you will, to focus on our local, our state offenders. And for instance, when their federal counterparts, like Jack Smith, might identify the more national players. And we've already seen that not only in his indictment to this state, but also but other things that we have seen in connection with the grand jury proceedings there. This two-pronged approach that it contemplates both a federal prosecution, but also a state prosecution here, as it is going ahead in Michigan and Georgia, presumably in other states, is factually fairly common in the American justice system. And it helps to ensure that the rule of law is advanced, that all implicated parties are brought to justice, and that state interests in the enforcement of state law are in fact advanced and promoted in state prosecutions. Nothing to prohibit the pursuit of those state cases if indeed a federal case is down the road coming. Nothing to prohibit that right now from charging those state fake electors. As significantly, another important point, and that is with respect to the other state prosecutions, the prosecutions going ahead in Georgia, in Michigan, in other states cannot be the venues for the prosecution of the state electors here in the state of Wisconsin. So, for example, Fani Willis does not have jurisdiction over the state fake electors here in Wisconsin. She doesn't have jurisdiction over the fake electors in Michigan. Likewise, the Attorney General, Dana Nessel, in Michigan, does not have jurisdiction over the Georgia fake electors, or over the Wisconsin fake electors, or over the fake electors in Pennsylvania, in other states out there. Why? Because those folks who are responsible for enforcing state law, can only prosecute those people who engage in conduct that happened, that occurred in that particular jurisdiction, in those particular states. So there's nothing about those other state prosecutions that could vindicate, could address the state interest here in Wisconsin in a prosecution here. Similarly, there may be very different interests in a federal and state prosecution as this matter goes forward. Nothing prevents the pursuit of the state electors here. Nothing about this otherwise is prevented by the conduct of and review of an investigation of the sort that the Attorney General, at least up to this point, has indicated he neither confirms nor denies. In connection with that, we also know that in March of 2022, in connection with a complaint brought to the Wisconsin Election Commission, at that time, that group determining whether or not these fake electors had engaged in any violation of state elections law, the Attorney General at that time had issued an opinion, a lengthy legal analysis from the State Department of Justice that concluded that the fake electors were not trying to do anything in violation of state law. They weren't trying to fool the Senate, but instead, according to the Attorney General, were legitimately trying to preserve Donald Trump's legal standing as courts were reviewing that matter. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the implications of that opinion rendered by our Attorney General about 18 months ago that could also have an implication for the state prosecutions here in the state of Wisconsin against those fake electors. Stay with us for that further consideration. This emptiness that I live with, I love you. This loneliness inside, darling, makes me feel half alive.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
CBS News Special Report. The Iran-backed Palestinian militant group Hamas is attacking Israel at this hour. Hamas gunmen have streamed into Israel, and thousands of rockets have been fired into the country. The BBC's Yolanda Nil.
Here in Jerusalem, we did see some of the rockets that came here in quick succession earlier in the morning being intercepted by the Iron Dome. But it will be a big concern for people that a lot of rockets do appear to have hit inside residential areas.
There are reports that at least 100 Israelis have been killed. Yonatan Yagodovsky is with an Israeli emergency service.
Deploying all of our ambulances, mobile intensive care units, and bulletproof ambulances. Our blood services called the public to come and donate blood.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Christopher Cruz.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For WCFW and the Tap FM, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. Chippewa County Sheriff Travis Hakes released a lengthy statement Thursday refuting multiple parts of a report that is leading to a vote next week to remove him from office. The report says Hakes didn't do parts of his job and profited from his role as sheriff by selling real estate and other items on the side and had inappropriate communication with a coworker. Hakes denied most of the allegations and said the report was politically motivated. The Chippewa County Board will vote on Tuesday whether to remove him as sheriff. One board member has already called for Hakes to resign. A man is seriously hurt after being trapped inside of a combine that had rolled over Wednesday in Trumbull County. The sheriff's office said that the 48-year-old man was driving north on a road near Arcadia when he went to turn off of the road, but went into the ditch instead. The combine then rolled over and pinned the man inside. He was flown to a hospital with serious injuries. Today's weather, cloudy with scattered showers, highs only getting into the low 50s. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Howler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Timeout!
Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
And we are back here on Morning Cannolis. We're at the bottom of our second hour. Thank you for staying with me, engaging with me in this morning's civics lesson about everything from the Supreme Court, which we're going to get to in the remaining segments of this hour, but also cases pending in our federal and state courts across America. Also talking about our Constitution this morning, 14th Amendment, and in this segment, also finishing up our discussion about fake electors. A lot of time spent in our previous segment talking about the options for prosecuting criminally the fake electors and false electors here in the state of Wisconsin. Also noting that about 18 months ago, in connection with a review of this same issue, not in a court proceeding, but in respect to a complaint that was filed with the Wisconsin Election Commission about the conduct of our fake electors, our attorney general in this state issued an opinion. And the analysis from the State Department of Justice at that time concluded that since the outcome of the presidential election was still in doubt on December 14th, that the electors were within their rights when they cast their votes for Donald Trump to ensure that the Senate received them by the deadline. Some factual concerns about that, again, premised upon my previous recitation of the facts as of that day. The specific memorandum said this. This memorandum, again, this coming out of our Attorney General's office, concludes that the complaint, again, the complaint, not civil, not criminal, administrative, a complaint filed with the Wisconsin Election Commission, does not, the Attorney General found, raise a reasonable suspicion that the respondents, here in this case, the identified fake electors, violated Wisconsin election law. Since they cast their votes, even though the canvas did not reflect a Trump victor, in order to preserve the opportunity for votes to be counted if a court challenge found that Trump received the majority of votes. So once again, some differences there about the factual predicates of what was known and premised upon, some conduct premised upon as of that date on December 14th, but a finding by our attorney general at that time that presumably would implicate the intent, the purpose of those fake electors here in the state of Wisconsin, admittedly focusing upon state elections law. That's the jurisdiction of the Wisconsin Election Commission. But finding in that connection that, with least respect to the matter involving the Wisconsin Election Commission, no basis for finding that they had violated Wisconsin law. In the wake of the statement by the governor of the state of Wisconsin, that there has to be some accountability here, and that what they, the fake electors, did was wrong. And so, as Tony Evers said, hoping somebody will pick up the banner here, because that has to happen. Let us go forward and identify the mechanisms which are there statutorily, the strategy there for pursuing a state prosecution. Let's advance all of that, notwithstanding this earlier opinion by the Attorney General sent to the Wisconsin Election Commission. Let us do justice here in the state of Wisconsin, as the other prosecutors in Georgia and the state of Michigan has done, identifying the state interests in addressing the misconduct, the criminal behavior of the electors in those states, even if down the road, Jack Smith and the federal government does in fact return further indictments against the electors, nothing that prevents today the prosecution of those electors here in the state of Wisconsin. We'll talk more about that as the elector issue continues to be the focus of discussion, not only here on this broadcast station, but in others around the country. Lots of political and governmental and indeed litigation discussion about those issues going forward. Let us turn now, as promised, to the other major issue of this past week, which is the new term of the United States Supreme Court. First Monday in October, always the start of the new term of the state of the United States Supreme Court. Indeed, the Supreme Court just this past week entertained three oral arguments in three very different cases involving sentencing issues, involving the future of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and involving the Americans with Disabilities Act. Let's talk about what was before the court just this past week. Before we do that, identifying the fact that the Supreme Court has now got on its docket 24 cases, up from one just last week, presumably going to be identifying more cases down the road, none yet from the Seventh Circuit or the Fourth Circuit or the Tenth Circuit, but plainly populating its docket as it goes forward. The first case before the Supreme Court just this past week, a case called Pulsifer, Pulsifer, versus the United States of America. The case began winding its way the legal system about 3 years ago when a defendant named Mark Pulsifer sold about a third of a pound of methamphetamine to a customer who turned out to be a confidential informant. And after that arrest, Pulsifer pleaded guilty to a felony count of methamphetamine distribution. Because of his criminal record, he'd been convicted of another drug-related felony several years earlier. He was suddenly facing a mandatory minimum sentence of 180 months in federal prison. Now, unfortunately for Pulsiver, mandatory minimums are not exactly in vogue on Capitol Hill these days, and even a lot of judges are looking again at the wisdom of imposing that. And in 2018, Congress passed the First Step Act. We talked about this a little bit in our last broadcast. This criminal justice reform bill that, among other things, allows judges to deviate from those mandatory minimums, including in Mr. Pulsiver's case, for people convicted of nonviolent drug offenses. And there's a provision of that federal law, it's called the safety valve, that assigns some point values to different offenses and defines the group of people who are eligible for certain sentencing reductions according to whether they've got a significant criminal history, a prior serious offense, and a prior violent offense as well. And that word "and" is all important, because that's what the Supreme Court was talking about just this past week. That may sound like a lot of numbers. It is. It may sound like a lot of language, and it is. And believe it or not, the Supreme Court, in the very first case that it heard on Monday of this past week, was trying to figure out what the word "and" means, whether "and" means "and" or "and" means "or." Turns out that Mr. Pulsiver was more than four total points from his previous three-point conviction, but never convicted of a two-point violent offense. And so he says the safety valve covers him. If you're following all this, people aren't eligible for sentencing relief only if they meet all three criteria, he says, A, B, and C. He doesn't, and therefore he's ineligible for this safety valve reduction in his sentence, or as his lawyers put it before the Supreme Court this past week, the plain meaning of the statute is unambiguous, and means and. Now, federal prosecutors, you may not be surprised to learn, felt differently. And in the government's view, the view of the U.S. Department of Justice, anyone who fails to clear any of those three hurdles identified in this law, again, the First Step Act passed by the Congress back in 2018, anyone who fails to clear any of those hurdles is ineligible for the reduction in their sentence, basically arguing that "and" means "or," "and" means "or." And so by late morning, the justices, as I suspect many of us are, were understandably exhausted by these oral arguments taking place on Monday morning. Clarence Thomas, for example, frustrated by the absence of apparently even kind of a workable framework for trying to answer the question, drew an analogy between the debate to his least favorite concept in constitutional jurisprudence, a substantive due process of the word "and" that we make up, he said, just as we go along. That's Clarence Thomas talking. Sam Alito wondered out loud if the debate's existence might be evidence that his beloved textualism has a dark side after all. He said, people who haven't studied the case might think this is gibberish. It might as well be Greek. That's Sam Alito. Maybe the most interesting exchange is, again, this case involving sentencing. And yes, indeed, it's very important. It's thousands of people whose sentences depend upon what the Supreme Court decides here. The justices are finding ways to wade through this linguistic gymnastics, if you will, the minutia, to talk about the real world stakes here, not just because of Mark Pulsiver, but the lives, as I said, of thousands of others who could quite legitimately spend many years less time in prison as a result of all of this. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said the Supreme Court should construe a purported ambiguity as narrowly as possible in favor of those defendants. She said this: I appreciate that "and" can sometimes mean "or" in everyday speech, but this is not a conversation. This is a statute, she said, and it's a criminal statute with huge implications for the lives and well-being of the people who come through the system. Jackson and the colleagues on the bench again Monday morning returned several times to the fact that safety valve relief is not automatic, but justices decided that this particular question, the defendants, in fact, have to wrestle with this. They have to meet several other eligibility criteria and also convince a judge of their worthiness for this discretionary relief established once again under the particular statute here. A lot of people focusing upon not only the language here, but the implications of this important case, Pulsiver versus the United States. We probably will get the decision out of the Supreme Court sometime in the spring or summer of next year. Unclear on exactly how the Supreme Court may go on this, as always, but certainly an awful lot of indication that the Supreme Court is willing, in this particular case, to interpret the law "and" means "and," and giving the benefit to those
defendants who might in fact be eligible for the safety valve under this particular act. We'll take a look at that, and we'll see if indeed both the conservatives and the liberals on the bench come to the conclusion that the language, although it's ambiguous, should be interpreted in a way that benefits Mr. Pulsiver and thousands of other potential and real defendants out there right now. That happened on Monday. Second case on Tuesday. This case also the subject of a lot of indication from our jurists that they've got some concerns about the ways in which this case is proceeding, doubts about the extent to which the attacks in this particular case have validity. What's this all about? Well, again, we talked about this last time. It's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau versus Commercial Financial Services. That is the name of the case. The court, again, wrestling with this issue about not only the rules that are being established, being set by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but also its very constitution, the ways in which it was put together. You may recall well that in the wake of the 2018 financial crisis in this nation, the Congress, led in many ways by the United States Senate and Elizabeth Warren there, put together this new entity of the government called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, entitled to exercise its authority under the law to ensure that financial interests of lenders, of borrowers in particular, with respect to lenders, are supported, and that various practices of lenders are not abusive to people in our financial system. So what happens along the way is that there is an attack upon the legitimacy of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, yes, in connection with the ways in which the CFPB is issuing some rules about the ways in which lenders can enforce their rights. Along the way, the challenge to the CFPB is just this, that the way the Congress put this together back in 2018 is unconstitutional, they say, inappropriate under the Appropriations Clause of the Constitution. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, like the Federal Reserve, like other entities like the FDIC, not getting its funding through the appropriations process, but getting it through the Federal Reserve through an indirect method that establishes its funding, not through an appropriation by the United States Congress. And the allegation, the civil claim here, is because of that, the CFPB is unconstitutional, cannot stand, the particular rule here cannot stand, and all the things the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has done and will do in the future are unconstitutional. When we come back, I'll tell you more about how the Supreme Court almost unanimously responded with great skepticism to that argument as we continue to pursue our discussion here on Morning Cannolis about the United States Supreme Court and oral argument in this case on Tuesday.
Key slides into the ignition. The engine rumbles to life. My hand grips the throttle. New gear for my ride. The road, my invitation. The sound, the smell, the exhilaration. I am one with the bike. And the car in front of me suddenly turns in my lane. Motorcycles are everywhere, but too often go unnoticed. Please, always look twice, be alert, and share the road with motorcycles at all times. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. cents. The pin still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pin still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, a few sprinkles, otherwise mostly cloudy, and 52. 42 the low tonight, and 55 the high for your Sunday. Frost Sunday night as we drop into the mid to low 30s. Mostly clear skies overnight for Monday sunshine and a high near 51.
Currently 46 degrees.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
We are back in this final segment of Morning Cannolis. Thank you for staying with me and plowing through this civic discussion of all things United States Supreme Court, talking about sentencing issues happening in our federal district courts around the country, and now talking about the future of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Does it have a future? Well, it appears the majority of the Supreme Court on Tuesday this week were fully ready to reject this notion that because of the way of the funding of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that it should be found unconstitutional, invalidated, pretty much from their questions, signaling that whenever they decide this case, a majority of the court, maybe even all of them, are going to reject the sweeping arguments made by the lawyer for the lenders, whose challenge to the CFPB rule spawned this Supreme Court case. A ruling for the agency plainly would quiet concerns about the validity of the CFPB going forward since its creation, and would also quiet concerns about other institutions, including, for example, the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, and others. This ruling in the opposite direction, finding that there is a problem with the funding of the CFPB, could in fact bring down other institutions as well. Supreme Court probably not willing to go down that road. Several justices pushed back on the arguments being made. Justice Brett Kavanaugh said, Congress could change it tomorrow. There's nothing permanent or perpetual about this. Justice Elena Kagan said that the arguments being made by those folks who are seeking to have the CFPB undermined here. He said we're flying in the face of 250 years of history. Sam Alito, most aggressive questioner when the Solicitor General, the Biden administration's top lawyer, defended the CFPB. And others, of course, on the court also weighing in on all of this. We know as well that Elena Kagan accused the attorney for the finding that the CFPB is not, in fact, constitutional. She accused him of making an argument that has been decisively rejected by history. Sonia Sotomayor lamented, I'm trying to understand your argument, she said, and I'm at a total loss. Francisco, again, found little help from the conservatives. And as I said before, Sam Alito was the one who perhaps provided some support for the argument. But again, even Justice Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett sounded skeptical as well of the legal basis for the attack on the agency. So it appears from this particular oral argument that the CFPB will probably get a favorable decision. We don't know, but sometime in the spring or July of next year, Supreme Court will probably enter its decision, presumably based upon the tea leaves of this oral argument, finding that the CFPB is in fact legitimate. Finally, on Wednesday, October 4th, the Supreme Court turned to a case involving the Americans with Disabilities Act. In this case involving a tester about whether or not someone who's testing the ADA can in fact sue hotels for non-compliance with the law. And where does this case come from? What is this all about? Well, it has to do with a dispute by a person named Deborah Laufer, L-A-U-F-E-R. She's a disability rights advocate. She's brought hundreds of these lawsuits against hotels who are purportedly not in compliance with ADA rules. She's a Florida resident. She uses a wheelchair, and she also has a visual impairment. She doesn't intend to visit the hotel she is suing, but instead she claims that the complaints that she makes are an effort to force the hotels
to live up to their obligations to ensure that their websites, the things they post online, are in compliance with the law. And of course, this is a process called testing. It's well known that I'm a U.S. attorney, especially the civil division chief in two districts in this country. Testing under the Civil Rights Act is an appropriate procedure to determine whether or not particular entities are in compliance with civil rights laws. So Lawfer has brought a number of these suits, including some against the Atchison Hotels. At that time, they owned the Coast Village Inn and cottages in Wells, Maine, which is a particular hotel that she was focusing. The case, of course, focusing upon this notion that that particular hotel had failed at the time to provide information on its website about the kinds of things it would offer to people with disabilities. The district court dismissed Lawfer's complaint against the company, finding that she, because she never intended to stay there, she did not have standing. But an appeals court later ruled in her favor and said basically that the lawsuit could proceed because she experienced an informational injury as a result of the hotel's lack of accessibility. Lawfer is a person with disabilities, the court ruled, not just any one of the hundreds of millions of Americans with a laptop. And personally, again, the court appeals went on to say, suffered the denial of information the law entitles her to as a person with disabilities to have under the law. Interestingly, despite her victory at the appeals court, Lawfer's attorneys at the time urged the justices to take up the case when Atchison turned to the high court earlier this year. They asked the justices to rule in her favor and affirm the legal footing that the lower court said testers like her are on, writing court papers that without civil rights advocates such as this plaintiff, there would be no enforcement of the ADA. That kind of thing. The advocacy also pursued this past Wednesday. But this past summer, again, an interesting turn of events here, Lawfer dropped all of her pending lawsuits against hotels, including at the Atchison case, after one of her attorneys had apparently run afoul of some disciplinary prohibitions. And she said she didn't want to distract distract from her advocacy work. And she asked the justices to drop the case before them. But as they have done before, they decided not to do that, and they went on to reconsider her position. So what happens? What happens during the course of this argument? Well, the court, in fact, takes this all up and determines whether or not, in the end, notwithstanding her request that the case be mooted, basically, whether or not someone who is not going to be staying at a particular hotel does still have a right to pursue under the ADA. The Supreme Court, again, wrestling with this standing issue once again, wrestling as they did this past Wednesday about the specific rights and responsibilities of someone who is bringing a lawsuit under the ADA. It is a fascinating issue. It is, again, as the other cases are, hugely important for all Americans, not just with people with disabilities, but all sorts of people across the United States of America. The case, again, is going to be important in terms of understanding the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we will see once again what the Supreme Court does, presumably in a decision coming up sometime later in 2024. When we return next week, we're going to talk about three more cases pending before the United States Supreme Court, oral argument coming up on Tuesday and Wednesday, involving a number of different issues, including on Wednesday, a case involving, once again, gerrymandering, this one coming out of South Carolina. Join us again next week, when we consider again those cases and future cases still on the docket of the United States Supreme Court here on Morning Cannolis. Thank you for joining me this Saturday morning. Have a good week, everybody. Take care.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. school sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic Sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap. You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.